Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome, everybody. This is Season 3, Episode number 24 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio, we have...
Kaylee.
And you know who.
It's
me.
Oh, welcome. The money.
Welcome, Simon. And we also have a special guest here in the studio. Guest reviewing for us today is Chris Horman, otherwise known on Twitter as The Merca. Another of those long-time listeners, first-time callers. Welcome, Chris, to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and thank you for having me here.
Well, it's a pleasure. You're also going to help us out with a special topic for the show this week. We'll get to that in a little bit later on. In today's episode, Marion Cotillard plays a killer whale trainer in Rust and Bone. Bill Murray plays Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Hyde Park on Hudson. Nicholas Holt plays a beanstalk raider. And Gail Garcia Bernal plays an ad man in No. Chris, you're also going to help us out with a discussion about this year's Film Society programme, so we look forward to that as well. But first, before we get into the meat of the show, what is in the mailbag? Kaylee, you've been stirring up trouble today, haven't you?
I have. It all started with pineapple lumps. First, Rudy, one of our favorites, tweeters, said, "Thursday has become the worst day of my week, so at least I get to listen to Cinematica Cast, which is pretty much my highlight."
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
Isn't it payday on Thursday? Should be
well,
a good day.
Not for everybody.
Okay.
Some people get Wednesday, some people get Monday.
And some people don't get paid anymore and are just hanging out until the next, till they get another job.
Not anyone in particular.
No.
No. And then earlier today, you know, talking, it was quite hot in the studio today, so I was like, you know what, let's get on the pineapple lumps. Also, question.
The iced pineapple lumps.
Iced
not just
pineapple.
Any old. Not
yeah.
just any old. Yeah, you've been chilling them specially.
And speaking of chilling, had some... Then the tweets started coming in about the best cinema snacks, and it was really cake or death. It was from...
You haven't got any cheesy Mexican kind of, you know, microwave tortilla with lots of cheese as an option?
No, that wasn't tortilla. That was white bread and cheese. We'll get to we'll get to microwaves later. But David Larson started it off as things you can eat without goddamn rustling, because then the reviewer behind you won't club you savagely to death.
Should point out that he is the reviewer in question.
Do you know that we probably spent an hour talking about bags this week?
Yeah.
Just the rustles, the texture, the top.
It's important.
Yeah, it is important. No, that's what I mean. It
well, and actually, I've got a suggestion for you here, because did you know
did
that...
Did you hear that?
Yeah, that, well, that's right. Did you know that...
My ears just popped. It's just both sides are working. Right, it's like in a plane. That's brilliant.
In Hollywood, when characters, they're carrying bags of shopping from the car into the kitchen, and they put them down, you know, brown paper bags, which is the classic American sort of shopping bag, that they're made out of... brown material. They're not actually made out of brown paper, because they can't be rustling while you're trying to record dialogue.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
On film,
well,
right?
Never.
Yeah.
Especially if there's a lapel mic.
Yeah, exactly. So they're cheating all the time. So maybe you could get reusable. This is for the cinema the optimum cinema experience. Reusable
from the set. Like the set bags. We want the set bags. Is that what you're saying? Then we can reuse those.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, but a couple of weeks ago, I was here, and we're at a prominent Wellington cinema. We're recording this show in, just so you know the context. And I noticed that you have Jaffas here for sale, but you don't sell them in the traditional classic Jaffa cardboard box. You know, the way that's usually piled high on the shelves, like Snifters and what have you. You have them. In bulk, and then decanted, if you were, into a slightly smaller...
They have to breathe.
Yeah.
You can't just... Straight out of the box ain't right. You know that, Dan.
I know. Yeah. But it occurred to me... I was just trying to imagine what it was like for your staff you know, transferring them, that it was almost like one of those behind the scenes in
it's
a drug.
Behind the scenes in a drug deal,
you know, where they're sort of weighing out the drugs and putting them into the little Ziploc baggies.
Do you know? We have a room where they're all sitting in their knickers doing that, and we've got scales everywhere and stuff.
Exactly,
and a guy with a gun.
Because they can't. No, however many Jaffas go in, that's how many
right,
have to come
and we
out.
Know.
I'm looking forward to that tour after the podcast.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll go through it, you know. Like.
So any other suggestions that people made about Optimum Cinema feed nosebag experiences?
No, it was mostly just do not eat this or you will die.
Yeah.
So,
So there's lots of nos.
You know, the big thing for me is when people bring food, like, not from the cinema in there, like this big burger or Chinese takeaways or something. It's just kind of like...
Someone once told me the story that a woman pulled a kebab out of her bag and started eating it at a cinema.
At the Paramount in the old days, we used to get that quite a lot because Courtney Place being so fast food oriented now, people would be racing for it. And it happens a lot during the festival, doesn't it? You know, when you've got very little time between sessions, you just got to eat. And, you know, when I was on the door at the Paramount, if I saw somebody come in and you think, oh, you know, I really can't take it. Sometimes we would say, look, you can't bring that in here. If you thought you weren't going to get any trouble, but then sometimes it was like, oh, okay, we just go out the back.
I think. I reckon when you suggest to Bill and Co. that they actually have a hydration station where you can have like bananas and water and stuff, so that, you know, because you're just going from film to film to film, and it's like an event, isn't it?
It's like an outdoors sports event. It's like my fruit cart I told you about. I want to have at the cricket.
Yep. That's
fresh
right.
Fruit cart.
A fruit cart, so, you know, you can just. You're on the go, they tag you, yep, you've come into this film.
Yeah.
Grab your water, throw it on the ground when you're finished because it's, you know, like you're running.
And you can't stand still.
No.
You actually have to keep moving.
James Bond
you've got your
style.
Banana. That's right. Pointy hands.
Pointy hands running.
And that's the, you know, and you could, yeah, I reckon that'd be cool.
Oh, I think we should be organising all of this, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
So did nobody this afternoon come up with like a positive and absolute, like the golden, unimpeachable sugar or protein option when you're at the movies?
No, it's more about eating and death threats.
Draft beer.
I don't know. Yeah,
Kelly Dare suggested that because she one of her favourite cinemas is the Alamo Draft House in Austin in Texas, where you actually sit at tables and eat your meal and have a beer. And it wouldn't surprise me if somebody tries to open one of those in Auckland. I know who would try and do it.
I just find that sort of thing intrusive, particularly, I mean, if it's during the film.
Yeah.
You know, fine beforehand and all that sort of thing, but I don't like deliveries being made.
No, well, I found
you get
that at Gold Lounge, don't you?
In the Gold Lounge,
where people just wandering in halfway through the film to deliver their cheese and crackers or whatever.
That's why I don't sit in Gold Lounge.
No, exactly. So you save money and you don't get the interruptions. It's like a double bonus, isn't it?
That being said, I would like to sit in Gold Lounge. I would like to, but I'm just putting this out there to. You know,
all right, to anybody
universe,
who might want to...
please stop food deliveries through the film.
Well, yeah, I was sitting in Gold Lounge last night, but I was the only one in my entire row, so I didn't feel guilty about disturbing anyone to get my banana split.
Right.
Banana split.
Oh, arriving. Nice! Yeah. But that's fine, but I just think it should happen during the trailers and the pre-match entertainment.
Yeah.
You know. But nobody just... For me, you know, I mean, I must have said, it's sort of like going over to the dark side, but I always like my popcorn. You know, I think it's because it's something we don't, you know, use, and so we don't have it, and so it's like, you know... I'm really getting out there.
Did I tell you about the popcorn that they serve at the Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
I'm hungry.
Parmesan and truffle oil.
Get out of town.
Popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I could only get halfway through it, eh? It was so rich.
Sounds good.
That
sounds great.
But do you remember the days of intervals?
Like, yes.
It's not actually that long ago when every film had an interval, and so halfway through it, you would, you know, the lights would come up, and you'd go out, and you'd stock up again. So you know, maybe there's the
only time now is with the Met and things like that. You know, these long alternative content shows where you get these built-in. I mean, you need to have that break. Yeah.
It is interesting, you know, that, but you know, sometimes when you get those retrospective screenings and of films from the 50s and 60s, like My Fair Lady or what have you, and they have the overture playing. You know, it's almost as if there's an orchestra there playing you in. You know, that sort of experience, I think, is really sort of missing from the world of cinema. So get onto it, Hollywood, please, and sort yourself out.
I reckon with digital, you can select your session. like, you know, in the past, it had to be, you know, it's hard locked in. But now I think you could actually create shows digitally, say, right, well, we're going to do it for the 8 o'clock, but we're not going to do it for every session of the day. Because the big argument with that was, well, okay, you're losing, you could potentially lose, you know, a film.
And films are long enough as they are, aren't they? Let's be honest. Right, so, yeah, but exactly. So you could just say that the 8.30 session, the last one of the day, is the grand session.
So pay a little bit extra. Stuff. I reserve, that's my idea, everyone.
Right. Well, you know, but I don't think you can really say that on Cinematica, because we are about sharing the good ideas wherever they, you know, wherever
only
they
if it come. Suits.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Too.
We're sharing the idea, but Simon's just going to use it first.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Good.
Talking
of going to the movies, as we have been, what have people been going to see, Kaylee?
Yes, well, coming in at number 5 this week, down from number 3, Broken City. In at number 4, up from 6, Silver Linings Playbook. Yep.
Really?
Really.
I added to that because I just saw it at the weekend.
Excellent.
Okay. And what do you think?
I liked it for the most part, but the ending just, I don't know if the ending was quite what I expected, but more... If it deserved that happy ending.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if it entirely earned it. That's right. Yeah.
I've heard that from a few people.
Yeah. At number 3, down from 2, I Give It a Year. At 2, down from 1, Oz the Great and Powerful. And opening at number 1, Jack the Giant Slayer. And also, interestingly, speaking of intervals in the opera, at number 8 this week is Met Opera's Aida.
That is on fire. Mm. Honestly,
oh, really?
That
is that
being
going
well
off?
Supported. Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting how with the Met you get these ones that just hit it out of the park.
Well, it's an incredibly popular show.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a lot of brand recognition, Aida, I would say, that you know, the elephants and all of the rest of it. It's one of those ones that people know, and there's a lot of hits.
But it's also, it's that audience knows if, for example, its production values are right and if they've done a good job of it. It's like they've got a sixth sense about, you know, well, that version of it is
going to work.
Spot on. Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. Quite enjoy
all
those.
Right. Good stuff. Well, thank you very much, Kaylee, for that. I noticed that it was a very big weekend in the US. The Croods, which nobody really knew quite what it was going to do this weekend, has done over 40 million US in its opening weekend, and that's right up there with How to Train Your Dragon, which is like the benchmark for non-Pixar.
It's a cracker, right?
Yeah.
It's a real cracker.
So that bodes very well for the amount of attention that it's going to get when it comes out in New Zealand in a couple of weeks for the school holidays. So that's something to
it's sneaking this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is it? Right.
We have two weeks of preview screenings because it opens, what, on the 11th of April?
Yeah. Well, there you go. We could debate that.
So you've got the long weekend and then you've got the next weekend.
I suppose so. They're not really sneaks, are they?
Really, no,
when you tell everybody about them.
Well, it's a bit of a sneak. It's in-house. Sort of.
Now, Chris, you're here to in two capacities. One, as a very well-respected two-word reviewer, and we're very glad that you've come in to share those with us.
But it's not fair. But anyway, you know.
But also because you are a committee member for the Wellington Film Society, and it's the film societies in Wellington and Auckland and pretty much the rest of the country are now underway, aren't they? It's a big year for the film society.
It certainly is.
Can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, what the program highlights are for this year for most of the country?
Yep, sure. So with the film societies, we tend to have a program which are shown across most of the film societies in New Zealand, but then there can be variations within each centre. So I can certainly talk to the Wellington programme, which does cover most of the film societies. So probably our centrepiece director screenings are, we've got a series of films by Claire Denis, who's shown during the film festival, but we thought the time was ripe for people to see some of her older films. So we've got three of her films, of which the first one, Beau Travail, we're screening straight after Easter in Wellington. And then we have 35 Shots of Rum. And
sounds good.
It does. Last Man Standing.
And Boy Meets Girl, I think, is the other Claire Denis film that we're showing As I desperately look through my notes.
Now, fair enough, fair enough too. Now, what it seems to me that the Film Society is doing particularly well this year is for people who maybe saw films at the festival by particular directors or like Leo Carax,
yes,
perhaps, or maybe David Cronenberg had a film out last year, the Society's reached into the back catalogue for those directors and said, well, if you liked these, you should check out these older ones.
Absolutely.
And it's just showing its value, I think, as a film studies course, if you like, a chance to sort of, you know, encourage people to go and examine the back catalogue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like you said, the David Cronenberg had the Cosmopolis out last year, and we're going to be showing Videodrome. In fact, I think Auckland had their screening of Videodrome earlier this month, which I understand went very, very well. We're coinciding our Videodrome screening with Halloween, so we're going to have a bit of a Halloween theme on that one. But probably one of my highlights that we are showing is David Lynch's Eraserhead. To be able to see that on a big screen with hopefully a full audience is going to be great.
It's going to be like a film festival from the mid-'80s, isn't
yes.
it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So great nostalgia for a particular generation of people. Those Eraserhead posters were up in flats all over Wellington, right, weren't they?
I think still are.
Yes.
We also delve into the past, so we've got some screwball comedies from the 30s. So a couple of films by Leo McCarey, Ruggles of Red Cap, and one which we showed just this past Monday, The Awful Truth.
That was brilliant.
It was. It was a lot of fun.
That was fantastic. This was Cary Grant and Irene Dunne, mm-hmm. and you know any chance you get to see Cary Grant in a comedy, he really is just head and shoulders above any of the comedy actors that we have on screen now. You look at the Jim Carreys and those sorts of people and you think, oh, you know, you're pretty funny, and then Cary Grant turns up and he just absolutely blitzes them.
Absolutely.
He really is. He's got the physical comedy, he's got good looks, he's got magnificent timing, and he sends himself up as well. So, you know, those films from the 30s, they're a portrait of a past age, but they're also very modern as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm. So, but it isn't just about looking backwards, is it? There's usually with the film societies, there are some seasons of films from around the world that are relatively contemporary, aren't they?
Well, yes, and so a good example of this is the Dreileben trilogy that we've got. We show in association with the Goethe Society, who have always been big supporters of the film society, and that's three films by three. Three different German directors, including Christian Petzold, whose film Barbara is about to start screening here in Wellington, and they take the premise of an escaped prisoner to start with, and then they all have a different take on that story. We don't know too much about it other than that. So that's going to be quite an intriguing watch to see how the three directors do take that story and bring it to a conclusion. Apparently, at the end.
Right, the Alliance Française have got their own French film festival now, which is doing fantastically well around the country. In the past, they've also supported the film societies with a programme of French films. Is that still continuing?
Yes, yep. So they've supported us with the Claire Denis season, which I talked about, as well as the Léos Carax films. And again, Léos Carax is someone who's very much... uppermost in people's minds because of Holy Motors last
year. Exactly. If you saw Holy Motors and you haven't seen his previous work, this is a fantastic opportunity to sort of delve a little bit deeper into that imagination.
Absolutely.
Mm. And have you got a personal highlight? Is there a date that you've said that you absolutely can't work late?
As I said before, Eraserhead will be. I don't want to miss that. But then there's a film which showed at the film festival a couple of years ago called Nostalgia for the Light, which is a Chilean film, and it's a documentary covering astronomy, archaeology, but also looking at Chile's recent past in the Pinochet regime. And I think that'll be a highlight for me. I'm looking forward to that one.
So how much? When does the work start? Like, how long ago did you start getting this program together? You know, and how do you coordinate that with the other sort of, you know, Auckland and Christchurch?
So we have a management committee. So the New Zealand Federation of Film Societies, and they're actually meeting in May to look at next year's program. So so we get ideas together. All of the film societies can provide ideas as to the sorts of films we might want to look at.
Does the audience give any feedback on that?
We do get feedback from our members, we've tried and take that on board. So that we have had in recent times requests for some lighter fare.
Right.
Obviously this year we have got the screwball comedies to kind of break it up from some of the more serious subjects that that we can cover. Yeah,
because I'm always fascinated, because I mean, you know, these titles and the amount of time that must go into actually getting the approval to play them, you know, it would take a lot of sort of behind the scenes chipping away and locking them down.
And we're very lucky in that we do work with the film festival, and one of the staff at the film festival was actually employed by the Film Society to go out and look for films on our behalf.
Nice.
Very helpful. Something else that I noticed earlier on this year is that you actually have a vault of your own. You actually have a store of films that somehow have managed to join your collection.
Yes.
And one of those played in Wellington the other week, a Mike Leigh film called A Sense of History, and it was a very unusual film to see. You know, it was not... I don't think it ever got a big screen release. It was only ever a festival film in the early 90s, I think. First of all, how many films do you have in your collection, and how did they get there?
Well, I guess they've just accumulated over time. To be honest, I couldn't tell you how many. Not that I don't want to tell you.
Secret.
I don't actually know, but... There are a lot, and when it comes to choosing some films that are individual to film societies, we can look into our vault to see if there's anything that maybe hasn't been seen or hasn't been seen for a long time. And we wanted to pair something with, we had a shorter film, La Jetée, this year, and we needed another shorter film, and so we jumped into the vault, and we thought that was a nice one to show.
Yeah, I remember hearing stories about there are a few Tarkovskis in the Film Society's collection, and they were actually donated, those 35mm prints, and they're very, very rare, actually. They were donated by the cultural arm of the government of the Soviet Union at the time as part of
a cultural exactly.
And you know, those things are gold now. You know, they're very, very hard to get hold of, and of course because they were given freely by the Soviet government, there's no problems with rights. There's a lot of gold in there. Maybe Si can talk to you a little bit later on about jazz films.
Well, exactly. It's ripping through my mind right now. But also, how do you view the whole transition to digital then, and getting, you know, these, because obviously you're playing a lot of, you know, classic films, or strong art films from the past, and so how do you, you know, you want to maintain that, and yet will they eventually be something that you'll show in a digital format?
I think that's definitely the way we're moving along with everyone else. I mean, we try wherever we can to show in 35mm because we are a film society, but we also have to. We have to think about the other film societies, and there are some very small film societies around the country which don't have the facility to show on 35mm.
And there are some bigger cinemas that are losing their ability to show 35mm as well. They're going the other direction.
Yeah, that's right. They are, because of the content isn't there. I mean, interestingly, today, I mean, Park Road Post announced that they'd be closing their film production.
Exactly. So that's the last, Park Road Post closing their lab. That's the last lab in the country. I think there's only one now in Australia that'll process 35mm film. I saw a posting on Facebook today. Somebody had posted an email that they'd got from Fujifilm in Los Angeles saying basically the final clearance sale of all of their film stock. So, you know, by the end of June, That'll be gone, so they won't be selling any more 35 millimeter film. This is in Hollywood, but the interesting thing to me about that was that there are the two New Zealand feature films that will have been released in the first half of this year. Shopping, which is coming out soon, and Mount Zion were both shot on 16 mil, so they were both shot on film. Processed by Park Road Post, and that's going to be an option that's not available to directors and cinematographers in the future. And
the question, because with this digital conversion, is do you feel like something is lost in the process if you get a Potemkin or something like that, and you're converting it into a digital format, and then do you think you're losing something, or is it? Do you know what I mean? Long term, I mean, that, I guess is what the future holds, isn't it? Is that you'll be playing them in that format, and does something get lost in that process?
I guess there are people who do feel that, you know, unless they see something in film, they a little bit of the soul of the film is gone if it goes to digital.
Mm.
But then there is the other argument around wanting to show it in its best available format, and I think that is a view that holds more sway these days.
And
accessibility, and I think, you know, like you say, if you can get that, you can now go to more and more locations if you want to and play those films, and I think that's it'll be the same every time, which I think is a real bonus, and so you are maintaining that history in a way that, you know, film can't. I mean, it's more permanent.
And if you can get a digital print, a digital print, I say, of an original, then really you're seeing it the way that the director hoped you would see in all of its glory.
And that's the argument that's being made about the restorations that are coming through, the Guys and Dolls and the Lawrence of Arabia that are coming through as part of the film festival's autumn season.
It's fantastic. Cause, I mean, compared to a few years ago when you wanted to play a classic film or you wanted to do a classic season or something like that, it was so hard to get the prints, and you had to really look after, you know, like you had to be really careful.
Yeah, in fact, there was only one cinema, there were two in Wellington that were actually entitled to be able to play archive prints, the Paramount and the Film Archive itself, because with archive prints, you weren't allowed to splice, so you had to have two projectors.
Mm. And also Tapapa is also their archival projection one.
But that's dropping away. But it seems, you know, we watched the Leo McCarey film on Monday night, and that was on 35mm, and I think that's something. I think this argument is only really, we're only able to really able to have this now since DCP and since digital projection has got to a point where we can say that it's now transcends the rough edges of 35mm. But in the past, digital was really only a standard definition or a DVD.
Mm.
And so you'd watch an old film from the 30s played off DVD and you think, well, I could be doing this at home.
Mm.
But DCP, you don't get that quality at home. Yeah. You don't get the colour depth. You don't get the resolution and
the brightness.
So I think we're now at a stage where if you get the chance to look at a restored version, frame by frame restoration of something classic on DCP without the flicker and without the judder of an aging 35mm print, then that's got to be the preferred way to go. We've drifted off the subject a wee bit,
interesting. It's just all interesting.
And it's a challenge for the Film Society's organisation because you've got so many different sub-organisations or sub-societies to support. What's the smallest film society?
I can't tell you. I just
don't want anyone to be offended.
No. There is a very small one down near Dunedin, and I'm just trying to remember the name of it. It's but I can't. I mean, that had a membership, I think, of around 70 or 80 off the top of my head.
You see, even that's not bad.
Mm.
That's not bad. So is the Film Society's network, is the Film Society flourishing at the moment?
Yeah, it's holding its own. I wouldn't say it's necessarily flourishing. We've in Wellington, we've maintained a membership of around about 500 members for the past 3 or 4 years, which is pretty good in the face of a lot of competition. It used to be that if you wanted to see art house films, your film society was the place you used to go. And I know our current president, David Lindsay, talks about the days where they had 2,500 people who were members of the Film Society. But you know, there are a lot more choices for people, which is great. But I think, you know, the fact that we can still hold our own, we get 250 people along to a Monday screening, Monday night screening, which is not traditionally a big night at the movies, shows that people are still willing to come out to share that communal experience of watching a film, enjoying it, and having a chat about it afterwards. So,
and it's a credit to your programs, I think, like you know, the train of thought that goes into what you're programming and so that there's a fluency to it, I think, is
exactly. And yeah, as we've just discovered, maintaining that fluency when those prints have to be shared around the entire country, I think there's a real there's an art to it. So well done. I'm looking forward to going to see as many as I can this year.
I have to go and see Eraserhead.
Yeah,
I have to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe you could be my number two. My plus one for that
one.
Wow. Yeah. I'll go in for Videodrome. I have fond memories of watching Videodrome very late at night at university
on VHS
in the film department. We had this little, I think they still actually have it there, this little tiny TV and a VHS and DVD player, and I watched Videodrome on VHS sitting on like the very old couch, being worried I was going to be swallowed by this couch. And like turned into something.
Right. Yeah, so lots to look forward to. Chris, thanks very much for helping us out with that.
No problem.
And you're going to be joining us for some of our reviews a little bit later on, but it's time to talk about Rust and Bone.
Et toi, t'avais beaucoup de mecs?
Avant?
Non.
J'étais avec Simon.
C'est tout?
Ben, il y en a une d'autre, mais pas beaucoup non plus d'ailleurs. Moi, j'étais très... J'aimais bien qu'on me regarde. J'aimais bien sentir que je séduisais. J'aimais bien sentir que je les excitais.
That's the luminous Marion Cotillard in Rust and Bone, Jack Odiar's new film. And Simon, you have seen this for us.
As have you.
Yeah. But I'm going to help you out if you get into trouble.
No. When did you see it?
I saw it back in September. Telluride, am I allowed to say that?
I think so. Yeah, you are.
Marion Cotillard.
But the funny
thing, I didn't sit next to her.
The funny thing is, I think I saw it around about the same time. It wouldn't have been far off.
No, and I saw it in Vancouver.
Oh,
Vancouver.
How many carbon credits have you guys got? I hate to see these films.
So many.
Jeez.
Yeah, well, it's just such a glamorous life, isn't it? Going from festival to premiere.
To Cineplex in your home city.
So, yes.
So your pants. No. So Rust and Bone. Look, it is, you know, it's from the director of A Prophet, and it doesn't fail. You know, it's consistent with the standards that we saw within Prophet, which I thought was...
You were a big fan of that, weren't you?
I was. Yeah. I just thought it was a brilliant film. And this is, you know, essentially about two people who are disconnected. They have their handicaps, whether they be physical or mental, and it's about how they connect and it's in a surprising way. And I mean, the film for me, I mean, it's mesmerizing from start to finish. And I mean, it starts following one of the characters, which is Matthias. Give me a hand with this.
Schonertz,
that'll do. That'll
close enough.
And he's on the run, sort of with his son. And you think, gee, this looks really tough. But they're on the run to basically get to his sister and start a new life. And he's kind of caring with his son without being too connected. Like he sort of looks after him, but in a pretty kind of, I don't know, you know, it's a funny relationship.
He's not really paying much attention, is he?
He's not exactly
going to get the Father of the Year award either.
But there is a funny bond, and it's well portrayed. I mean, it's interesting how they portray that. And a lot of the first part of the film is based around, you know, him and his son getting to where they're getting, and then him finding work, and of course, you know, he's an ex-boxer, and he starts to move into the bare-knuckle fist boxing events that are quite spectacular.
Yeah, which he does sort of for money, but sort of
it's just as
a sort of catharsis as well.
Yeah, yeah, this is what he's good at.
Yeah. And also there's something else about him as well, which is that sort of masochistic, you know, the there's almost a need for him to take a beating.
There's a financial need too. Mm. You know, and I think that's part of the attraction.
But there's a rage in him as well, you know. That's the other thing, that, you know, he's got a lot of stuff going on under the surface. It's a fantastic performance by him, eh?
Oh, it is. It's incredible. Yeah. And then Marion Cotillard's character comes along, and she's kind of disconnected in a way with her partner. Like, you can see when it's when it's presented that, you know, she doesn't kind of have a strong relationship with her partner. And it's, you're not too sure why there isn't a stronger connection, but she just sort of seems to be going along with it for the sake of it. But then events transpire which kind of change her life completely, and she's kind of lost, and she finds herself a little bit by connecting with this
yeah, she disappears chap. Into herself, doesn't she, as a result does. Of this as a result of this thing, you know, her purpose, her sense of purpose about her life disappears, and she has to try and find it again, and she sort of finds it in him to a degree, and which he takes a long time to work out how to reciprocate.
Well, because and that's because he doesn't actually have an emotional connection with people, and so, I mean, there's a fascinating part in the film where, you know, he just walks off and sleeps with another woman, sort of thing, and they're seeing each other at the time, and he's like, well, but, you know, he didn't really, he just saw her as a friend who he had sex with.
Mm.
You know, and it's only then that it slowly dawns on him when she's pretty annoyed that there's something, you know, else there, and so it's really fascinating how emotionally stunted he is. I think there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that in there, which is pretty hard hitting and pretty well done.
It is. Without going into too much detail, I guess, about exactly what happens, what did you make of the ending? Because I kind of felt like if it didn't have that ending, it would have been a really, really tough night at the cinema.
Do you know, I reckon people are going to debate this, you know, a lot. Now, close to the ending, you know, I mean, you can't say too much because you don't want to spoil it, but certain events transpire and well, I don't even know how to explain it, but without giving it away, but... You can see that the film could have gone in two directions. It could have finished there, and you would have gone, oh, you know, and then it carries off in another direction, and you're going to go, oh, hold on, it's going this way now, and so it does have that effect.
Yeah. And some people buy it, and some people don't.
Yeah, and it's still well crafted. It's still well done, and it's actually, I mean, it's a very powerful ending. You know, the scenes that just before the end are really powerful and tragic.
And you think it couldn't actually get much more powerful than it already has been.
But it is one of those films where you're kind of watching and going, gee, what's next? You know, there's a sense of foreboding. You know, like something's around the corner. Like the kid's walking across the road. Is he going to be hit by a car?
Exactly.
You know, like,
I find it's kind of got this. It's so tense.
It is. Yeah. It is. It's very, very tense like that throughout. You know, and sometimes the places where the actual you know, the sense of doom and where it's going to come from. It surprises you. It doesn't come from where you think it is.
Mm.
So, look, I really enjoyed it. I love these films. I think that, you know, this director is just an absolute... He's a brilliant director. And you know, if you enjoyed something like In Profit, which was a hard-hitting film, then I think this one's also for you.
This is a film that came second at Cannes last year to Amour, you know. And I said in my review for the
paper... Lighter than Amour.
Little bit, just. But I said it in my review of the paper that it's like there's no shame in coming second to Amour.
No.
You know. Mm. And I think in any other year, Rust and Bone could easily have taken out that top slot because it really is something quite unique and something quite special. Kaylee, what did you make of it?
Well, I reviewed this several weeks ago, actually, when I was on Christmas holiday.
But not everybody may have been listening at the time.
Well, you can go back and listen.
Picking up subscribers all the time, yes.
Yes, just absolutely glowing. I loved it. I really, really enjoy French cinema, especially when it's, like, this high quality. And just Marion Cotillard was amazing. Like, usually you see her, she's quite glamorous and quite beautiful, and, you know, she's been in these Hollywood films, and this, she's just, like, literally stripped down, like, to nothing, and it's gorgeous, and I love her character, and the way her character develops is fantastic.
Mm.
Just a really, really strong female character, which is a lovely break from a lot of the female characters we get in cinema.
The big surprise, because
she motivates him, like, you know, there's these pivotal scenes where he's having these fist fights, and she actually does things to put him back on track. You know, and she's excited by these fist fights, you know, and it's really interesting how they do that, you know, because here's this woman who's got this disability, and she turns up at these fights that are just completely dominated by men, and she's kind of in the corner at the start, but then as the film progresses, you know, her strength of character comes through, and she's there to be his wingman and to help him, and it's fascinating.
I want to put a shout out to Matthias Schoenaerts. the guy in this, who I'd never seen before. At the screening in Telluride, it was the screening I went to, it was a sort of Q&A for Marion Cotillard, and she was given an award, and so the first sort of half an hour was a conversation with her. And then he was invited up on stage to sort of say a few words about what it was like working with her, and we hadn't seen the film at this point. And so what we saw was this beautifully well-dressed, beautifully turned out, calm, handsome, charming, lovely guy, and spoke very well, and we thought, oh well he's what a very nice chap. And then we saw the film and we thought, how did that happen?
It's the magic.
It is the magic, exactly. And it's and when you see somebody new for the first time, you know, who you don't have preconceptions about and you don't have a whole history of watching their work, I really recommend that people go and see Rust and Bone just for that, because you won't have seen this guy before. And I tell you what, you're going to see a lot of him in the future, because he is the real deal, this guy. He's going to be...
He's her equal, completely.
Yeah, yeah, completely. So Rust and Bone, two words. Who wants to go first? Si.
I'm going to be very simple here, but yet very traditional. I'm just going to call it a masterpiece.
Oh, nice. That's a bold claim, but one that we're prepared to back up. Kaylee, what do you reckon?
Ooh, that's a hard one. I don't know if I can condense it to two words, but it's like...
It is very difficult.
What about the... Just
but if it was easy, we wouldn't ask you to do it.
And when you go to it, the special effects have still got my mind sort of going, how
did they do that? Yes, yes, exactly.
So just keep an eye out for that.
Okay, well, I'll give you my two words, and hopefully that'll provoke something in you. My two words: fireworks.
Oh shit! Oh, Katy Perry.
That was playing, wasn't it, when we walked in on somebody's radio?
No, it's phone ring. It's actually going to be the closing. It's going to be the closing music for the show. Actually,
Dan, if that was your ringtone, I'd be a bit concerned.
How can you do that to Rust and Bone? How can you use Katy Perry?
Because it's a pivotal song.
Is it in the film? I can't remember.
It is in the film.
Oh, there you go. I'm sorry, everyone.
Which is really funny and strange.
It's the best use of Katy Perry in cinema.
All right, I take it back. Well done, Dan. Brilliant. I thought it was because it was on a ringtone when you walked in here, and it was just
no. I was prepping for the show. We can't hold back any longer.
I'm going to go with Essential French.
Good. All right. So that's definitely a big vote of positivity for Rust and Bone.
It's time for a pineapple lump.
They just left Beacon.
Good. It won't be too long.
No king of England had ever visited America before.
So nice of you to come.
Mr. President, forgive me for not getting up.
So Franklin invited them here, to the country, where we could all relax.
Your mother has now told me for the 10th time not to call her Royal Highness Elizabeth.
Do you mind if I call you Elizabeth?
No. No.
It was just one of those
At the picnic, things. The President's wife has organized just that hot dogs be served things. As our main dish.
Are they trying to make fun of us?
I don't know.
This show might have to be split into two, actually, and put out over two different days. We've been going on quite a long time, actually, for this.
Have we? Hot dog.
All right. Hyde Park on Hudson. Who did we ask to do this one? Kaylee.
Yes. Step up to the plate.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. Well, Hyde Park on Hudson is... sort of two films in one. So what you have, which we heard about in the trailer, is we have royalty coming to visit Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the eve of World War II, and they're coming on their first official royal visit, and trying to secure relationship if they are going to go to war, that America and Britain will fight together. So you have... You have this story of, you know, the royals coming to America, and it's this comedy, and, you know, they're eating hot dogs and being served cocktails. And
it's a little bit of the King's Speech too, as well, isn't it? Because it's the same character from the King's Speech with the stammer.
Yes, Bertie. Yeah. Bertie. But then you've also got this sort of... this background story to Roosevelt and his womanizing ways, and told from the point of view of a distant cousin named Margaret Stuckley, who's played by the lovely Laura Linney.
How distant?
I think they say sixth cousin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so distant enough.
Good enough.
Yeah. And this is actually a story that they found in her diaries and letters after she passed away at the age of 100 of her relationship with Roosevelt and kind of what resulted. And these two events are kind of at the same time. And it's coming to
crashing
a head.
Crashing in together.
Yeah, so it was a bit strange. When I started watching it, because the trailer is mostly about the royal visit, which is quite a great kind of comedy, where and then this relationship is more drama. And so when the film started, I was a bit confused. I was like, has something been cut out? Am I missing something? But it was interesting. A little bit uncomfortable. Like, some of the first scenes are very uncomfortable and awkward and weird. but this is a character that we haven't seen a usual funny man Bill Murray play. And he's
jolly good, isn't he?
He's great.
Yeah.
He's so great. And there's a really, really lovely moment between himself and Bertie talking about their disabilities. I enjoyed it. But there was that kind of uncomfortable, like.
But there's this constant theme throughout, isn't there, of the British or the royal family not really sure how they're being treated. Are they being made fun of all the time? Mm. I saw a scene where they're in the bedroom and there's all these cartoons about the royal family being kicked out of America in the War of Independence and stuff like that, and they're in the same room, in their room.
Yeah, from a diplomacy point of view, it's a bit of a disaster area, isn't it, this first visit? And yet it's only the relationship between Roosevelt and Bertie that actually manages to sort of see them through.
Yeah, and this kind of sense that they're in battle, they're everything's a battle, like they're they go, well, at one point he goes, the people in that room, they're Irish, they're Italian, they all hate Britain at the moment. This sense of really being sort of circled and under pressure. And I thought that was an interesting, interesting play on it. And he sort of comes along, Bertie, and says, well, at the end of the day, we just have to be more confident. Yeah, which is such a British thing to do.
Mm.
But I already liked it. I thought the little scenes that I saw, because I was in and out a little bit, I quite liked what I was seeing, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I did. I found it a bit disjointed because there is at least two, if not three, stories going on at the same time. And because Laura Linney's character does a lot of voiceover, when it goes to the royal side of things, it's not from her point of view, so it's not narrated.
Mm.
So it feels a little bit disjointed.
That's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because when you've got a film that's being narrated and then you've got scenes that they couldn't possibly have known anything about, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Mm. And how does Roosevelt's character, how does he, in the end, how does it all wind up? Like, does he commit that we are going to find help? We're going to help Britain. We're going to come to the party.
Bertie,
you've built this relationship.
Or Bertie does it just eats kind the of, hot dog at the picnic. And that's like... That's Britain accepting America.
That seals the deal.
Right. I see.
Wow.
And Laura Linney puts mustard on in this really sort of like strangely
English sort of
English
way.
Semi-erotic kind of way.
I mean,
it's really uncomfortable.
It's pretty cool doing that with a hot dog. But the thing is, in some ways we should be more afraid of hot dogs now than he was back then, because they probably had real stuff in them.
They probably had real meat in them.
They don't live for 100 years on your shelf.
All right. So the what's the main reason for going to see this? Is it Bill Murray, or is there enough other stuff going on there as well? It's not a Bill Murray film that if you think, oh God, I can't stand Bill, he's always wisecracking. It's not one of those. But it is a great performance.
It is. I think it's definitely worth seeing the performances. And if you're interested in, quasi-American culture and sort of like scandal. And also, one of the reasons I was interested is, where is it? Olivia Colman, whose name I can never remember. She's one of my favorite British comedians. She is hilarious and she's really wonderful as Elizabeth.
Oh, she was the one that was even the, possibly the worst person in I Give It a Year, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was
therapist. Yeah, she was possibly the worst person in the world. I wanted to light her on fire. But yes, she was great in Hot Fuzz and films like that.
And she was fantastic in Tyrannosaur. She was incredible.
Right. I haven't seen. So yeah.
Yes. And also, if forgive me for mentioning television, I always remember her from Green Wing. She is fantastic in that as a very, very minor character. But
right,
pure comedy gold.
Si, did you see enough of it to be able to give us two words?
No. I'll dodge this one.
Kaylee, two words for Hyde Park on Hudson.
Oh, I'm not good at the two words this week.
Hot dog.
Oh, yeah.
Hot dog.
Hot dog disaster. Okay. I don't know.
It's all about the hot dog.
Okay, my two words.
Actually, it is. It is. Sex scandal, hot dog scandal, just hot dog.
All right, hot dog. Okay, my two words for Hyde Park on Hudson are Brilliant Bill. And time for some news.
It's not as good as hot dog.
No, it's about as good as what you usually come up with.
No, hot dog's good.
Thank you very much. Just as Canadian hit comedy Starbuck hits U.S. screens, it has been announced that writer-director Ken Scott is going to remake the film in Hollywood.
How can that be that Starbuck is only opening now? Because I mean, it's been around for
because we get films so much earlier here in New Zealand than everybody else
does.
Not
if you listen to the Twitter sphere.
No. I can't even finish this. This is so depressing.
Oh, carry on.
The new film will start.
I knew you'd love this story.
The new star.
Will Smith is in the lead.
No.
It would be so good.
Oh my God! Imagine that. I wish.
Actually, you need somebody who's had a lot of trouble with women to lead the star in it. Like,
oh yeah,
he's got
lots
of kids. Charlie Sheen.
Ew. Right. Yuck. Vince Vaughn, who's just as good. Will star, and it is called The Delivery Man. Now, I was thinking about this. Okay, the reason Starbuck is good and funny is because it's a French-Canadian film, and it's not serious, and it's making fun of itself. This American version with Vince Vaughn is going to be atrocious. It'll be the same story, it will be atrocious.
No, if it's got Ben Stiller in it, it'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Luke, what's his name?
Luke Wilson.
Yeah. Ben Stiller will be the neighbor or the friend.
And the little guy, the little round guy. What's his name?
I know the one you mean.
Danny DeVito?
No.
A cameo by Rob Schneider?
No. He was in...
The young one was in Django.
He was in the remake of the cop... Jump Street.
Yeah, another one. I can't remember.
Jonah Hill. Yeah, he's got to be in there too.
Yeah, okay. But it is being written and directed by the guy who did the original, so hopefully it is more than just a paycheck for him.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Have faith. In your Canadian countrymen.
If they made it, they could just leave it. It's good.
Hey.
It's funny.
Hey. Hey.
Okay. Speaking of Canada and winter things.
Hey.
In February 2014, the Winter Olympics are going to be held in Sochi, Russia, which you might think doesn't have anything to do with the movies, but you're wrong. Because the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, aka the Oscars, have decided not to try and compete with the curling, long-distance skiing, and something called skeleton, which is an awesome sport. And don't forget figure skating. You left out figure skating.
No, I just thought that naming a sport skeleton... I'd never heard of it before. It
sounds scary.
It is scary. Yeah. You're on this little tiny sled in a spandex unitard flying down like a bobsled chute.
Is it the difference between going head first and feet first?
Yes.
Is that the difference? One feet first.
Yep.
Right.
And skeletons head first.
Head first.
Oh, jeez.
Is that because you'll end up as a skeleton at the end of it?
Well, I think your skeleton will be liquefied by the end of it. There won't be any skeleton.
Anyway. They can't rely on people not watching the Winter Olympics.
Yeah.
So
I've done that down Wainui Hill. It's fine.
And probably because the Oscars were so bad this year.
Gives them an extra 2 weeks to sort their shit out, doesn't it?
They've moved their awards ceremony to the more sensible month of March. So stick March 7th, March 2nd, or the 7th, because you can do something better. March 2nd. Oh, sorry. 2nd in your... I'm still so angry about Starbuck. stick March 2nd in your diaries and put some money on Meryl Streep. Dead cert.
I reckon they'll do a coffee deal with Starbucks, too. I'll be looking for that sort of level of, marketing support.
They will.
Oh, yeah.
They will. All right.
And chairman of Sony Pictures, Amy Pascal, made an impassioned plea for Hollywood to do more to represent gay characters on screen at a fundraiser for the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center on the 21st of March. One key point she made was that often when Hollywood deals with gay characters and stories, the outcome is fatal, such as Brokeback Mountain, Milk, Boys Don't Cry, Philadelphia, The Hours, Gods and Monsters, Talented Mr. Ripley, A Single Man, My Own Private Idaho, and others. In all these movies, the main character is murdered or martyred or commits suicide or just dies unhappily.
Yeah, it wasn't until I saw that
when
story
you
I realized.
List, girl,
yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe you need to have a bit of a look at Hollywood. So
The Birdcage.
Yeah. Oh, that was happy, wasn't it?
Yeah, okay.
So there we go. More films like The Birdcage.
Mm. But also The Birdcage is overly camp. You know, that's a very, very camp.
Stereotypical gay scenario. Yeah. She did make a sort of a big shout out to Paranorman for having the first openly gay character in an animated film, and a character that wasn't made fun of or wasn't didn't have a tragic end.
It was just a fact.
Just a fact. Yeah, exactly. So more like that is what she was after. Mm. All right. Now this has been possibly the longest show in Cinematica history. So we'll just whip through the last two films before we say goodbye.
Three, five, four.
I saw your light and I'm lost.
What are you doing out in this nasty weather,
Your Highness?
These your books?
My father used to read that to me.
I like a good adventure.
I'm looking for an adventure of my own.
At last, mankind have returned.
They're uglier than I remember.
Jack,
is it Ray Winston?
No, I wish. Jack the Giant Slayer, which is directed by Bryan Singer, famous for The Usual Suspects and X-Men, and it is a retelling of the famous Jack and the Beanstalk fairy tale. Side, have you seen this one? You're looking primed and ready to give us an opinion on it.
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Right, nope. So is this one all up to me?
Jack's back.
Chris, you saw this last night.
I did see it last night.
What did you make of it?
Well, the story, the Jack and the Beanstalk story, it sticks pretty much to the story. Obviously, it expands on it to fill out a nearly two-hour film. But you've got Bryan Singer directing. You've got great character actors like Stanley Tucci, Ian McShane, Eddie Marsan, who's one of my personal favourites, and Nicholas Holt, who's really come of age, and he's gone from being a child actor to he's been in some interesting films, and so I thought, well, this sounds good. It doesn't quite come off in my mind as well. It's some of the scenes in it look like sub Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings type scenes. The effects are mostly well done, especially the giants. But I was thinking during the film, where are all the female giants? And the fact that I was distracted by thinking about where the female giants are and how they actually procreate.
They're not even in the kitchen, are they?
No.
Female giants.
Yeah. No.
It's dangerous territory, Dan.
I wasn't that taken with it, despite what should be a really, really good pedigree.
Isn't there a swashbuckling Ewan McGregor?
There is a moustache twirling Ewan McGregor in there, and he's all right.
He's got some great hair.
But the biggest problem that this film has is that this is a fairy tale, right? This is the when you're telling this story to kids, you're telling it to under fives, right? And yet the film itself has quite a lot of violence in it. Quite a lot of death, mayhem, and it really is pitched at a much older child or family audience, and it is the Lord of the Rings audience.
But the original story isn't kind of Disney, is it? I mean, you go back through time, it was quite a bone-crunching type of story, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it is a story that you scare kids with, I guess. But it seems to me, here's my take on it. I reckon that this is a film that New Line, who are the studio behind it, will have greenlit while there was all that faffing around over The Hobbit, when they weren't sure that they were going to get another Hobbit. And because this is basically, you were saying sub Peter Jackson, it's about right, because it's got a glowing metal circle that has powers that people want, right? So it's got one of those. It's got a lot of bloodless violence in it. There's quite a few deaths. This is basically the fourth Lord of the Rings film.
Okay.
And without but they've tried to create a whole world for it, and without really doing it successfully. I mean, it's entertaining enough, but I just don't know quite where it fits. Anyway, two what? Words. Anybody else seen it? Katie,
just coming on the heels of Oz.
Yeah. Oh, it doesn't compete to Oz,
right?
Yeah, no, I reckon that there will be an audience for it, not a huge audience. I just think that it doesn't quite know what it is. It doesn't quite know who it's for, and it doesn't quite know where it fits into, And you can sort of tell from the marketing of it. You know, it used to be called Jack the Giant Killer. They changed it to Jack the Giant Slayer for reasons that no one can be quite sure of. And apart from, it must have been marketing.
There's another film that came out in 2013 called Jack the Giant Killer.
Oh, okay.
There's another one. I found it because I was like searching the internet, and I was like, oh, nope.
Right. Well, maybe that's it. But either way, it just doesn't seem like it's quite knows who its intended audience is, mm-hmm. and how to sort of deliver it to them. Having said that, you know, it was a not unentertaining couple of hours, and a couple of New Zealand actors in there as well, I noticed, which was a pleasant surprise. So, and my understanding is that some of it was shot here, although you wouldn't know that from the credits at the end. I stayed till the very end to check the credits, and so you know, but there we have it. Two words, Chris, for Jack the Giant Slayer.
I'm going to go along with the hot dog theme, and just in relation to there being no female giants, and say Sausage Fest.
Nice.
All right, yeah, I can't really beat that one. So mine will just be doesn't fit for Jack the Giant Slayer. And one more film before we go.
El presidente va a ganar igual, dejémonos de hueá. ¿Dónde están los presos políticos?
Basta, hay que ser más creativos, carajo. Hay que darle la vuelta a esto.
A mí la democracia me parece entretenida.
Producto alegre, si tú lo planteas así.
Estamos utilizando un lenguaje publicitario, pero armando un concepto político detrás.
Porque sin la dictadura la alegría va a
This is a film that I've managed to miss on three different occasions.
Oh, so good.
I'm outraged. Seriously, I've wanted to see it at the festival last year, at Telluride, and at the Film Society, and I've missed it every single time. So I'm going to have to hand this one over. Who's going to be our Chilean political correspondent?
I will.
Kaylee.
Yeah, because I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, the white girl in the room.
But Chris, you would have seen it. You would have seen it at that Film Society screening.
I have, and at the film festival too.
Oh, right. Would you like to lead? You can be our guest leader.
No, you go for it.
I've already done one. You can do it if you like. Stars Gael García Bernal in all of his Spanish glory. Yay. Yes, and his short glory. It's like, there's even a comment in the film. It's like, why is that man in there? He's like 10 feet tall. Chileans, we're short. We're small people. And I was like, oh, yeah. Finally get to see on film that Gael García Bernal is actually tiny man. But wonderful nonetheless. So this is based in 1998 at the height or end of Pinochet's political reign of terror in Chile. And there is there's a forced vote, and the people have to vote yes or no whether he stays in power or not, to prove to internationals that the people actually want him there.
That there is democracy in Chile.
That there is
after
democracy,
all.
Yes, even though it doesn't look like that internationally. So Gael García Bernal is this hot young ad exec, and he's asked to join the No campaign, and his boss is working on the Yes campaign. They work for this very high-end ad agency, and political ambitions collide, and a great film comes forth.
Oh, wow.
That's my synopsis.
But how political is this character, or is it just a gig, like it's a job, and he just wants to beat his boss? I mean, is it... Do you know what I mean? Like, is his character...
Does he discover politics? Yeah, does he discover a sort of
passion?
Does he see
all the pain and suffering and think, you know, I've got to go with no...
Well,
what does he see as
it starts out
what ad man actually eats his own dog food, really? I mean, it's all about just getting the winning. It's all about winning, isn't it?
Well, it starts out
probably
starts as a bit as a job, but we're introduced to his semi estranged wife, who is a activist, and the first time we meet her, he's bailing her out of jail, and she's being abused by prison guards, and you know, she's They have a young son, and she's not around very much. She's busy with other things and kind of going up against the government. And she doesn't believe that he can do any change with this No campaign. And that's a real driving force, is that this isn't going to do anything. You're not going to change anything. And I think that was a driving force for him, because who doesn't be like, yeah, well, fine, I'm going to prove you wrong when someone says, no, you can't do it. I think the most notable thing about this film, which many critics have either celebrated or booed, is that it was shot on a U-matic camera, which is basically a VHS camera, to blend seamlessly with the archival footage and with the ads that they used, that they actually created.
Did they create the ads, or did they find the ads? How much of what we see on screen is the actual work of the agency?
I'm pretty sure that it was the actual ads that showed during the campaign.
It was. And he has these fantastic transitions where an actor in the film an actor would sit down like they're about to be interviewed for this ad campaign, and it would shift to a monitor and it would be the actual ad. So you're like, that person looks slightly different. This must be the real thing. So you can pick it out. But he did use a lot of the original advertising that was ran by both the Yes and the No campaign. I love low-def video. That's the reason why I really enjoy some of Harmony Korine's work, even though it's very, like, in your face. But I do like that lo-fi video of, like, the 80s kind of... So I really enjoyed this. I didn't find it distracting.
That's why you watched Videodrome on VHS when you had a possibility.
With those lines running through it. Oh, so good. When there's a imperfection in a VHS, it goes and starts again. So it is a bit funny because especially with the opening and closing credits, they do this fantastic thing. They have it on a flip chart, and you can really see, you know, the issues with the U-matic on that, because there's a lot of color separation, which I loved. And you there is a little bit of it throughout the film, but I think it just really added to it, and the fact that it just all blends together in this fantastic piece of artwork was really well. Now, he has received a lot of criticism that it wasn't accurate, that it's a fairly, you know, happy, uplifting portrayal of what was going on at that time. And I found this quote today.
A comedy about dictatorship, perhaps.
I found this quote of his when he was accused of oversimplifying the issue. Director Lavrine said, A movie is not a testament, it's just the way we see things. So I think that is a brilliant...
Nice.
Like, hoo-ha to critics.
Yeah, oh, that was going to be my question for both of you who have seen the film, is that, well, is there anything that comes out of this film that for us to take away in terms of... is there anything for us to learn about either the politics or about the media or persuasion? Or like, what relevance does it have for us?
I think it really pushes the idea of the power of the people and taking an idea and really running with it. And it does it in a really entertaining way. I really liked the style it was shot in, just because it gave it a real immediacy. So you felt like that the film was seamless between the ads and what was happening in the action. I found it quite inspiring, and it's not Mad Men, it's just really brilliant, and I'd recommend anyone to go and see it.
Good stuff. All right, so I'm going to ask you to see if you can reduce it down to two words, please. Who wants to go first?
My two words.
Oh, you've prepared.
I'm ready.
For this.
I'm ready. I thought of this like 10 minutes ago. Oh. My two word review would be yes, no.
Okay, pressure, Chris. There.
I will admit that I prepared this earlier as well, and I'm going with video verite.
Nice work. Love
it. That's excellent work. All right, and that is our show for this week. Thanks very much to Chris for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you in the studio. You can be found on Twitter as The Merker with a Y, and we'll provide a link to that in the show notes so that people can start following you, and also a link to the Wellington Film Society Twitter as well, so people can follow those updates as well. Next week, we have more supernatural spookiness from Twilight's Stephanie Meyer in The Host. G.I. Joe Retaliation is an unlikely sequel, and we'll also be talking about the latest from Danny Boyle, Trance. And on the subject of Trance, next Tuesday night at the Lighthouse Cinema in Cuba,
6 p.m.
I will be introducing a special screening of Trance, and I'll be introducing it with a kind of audio visual summary of Danny Boyle's career to date. So
a mini retrospective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it'll give you a chance to remember some of the films of his that you have loved, and also maybe inform you a little bit more about how those films got made and the collaborators and the kind of the subjects that he's been interested in. A sort of auteur theory introduction to Danny Boyle. So that's going to be happening at 6 o'clock on Tuesday.
And you really want a discussion group there. And I suggest that anyone who's listening who's going to go, you need to
do some homework.
Do some homework, and let's put it to Dan on the night. Let's put him under pressure.
Yeah, exactly. I've already bought and I'm about to read a biography of Danny Boyle, so I'll be up on all of the facts.
Good work.
I'm re-watching all of his past work, so tonight I'm going to watch The Beach with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh,
so I'm working.
I did that.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm working my way through them in order. And
the Olympic opening ceremony too, I hope.
Maybe not. Maybe I'll fast forward. Actually,
that's right.
But definitely looking forward to rewatching his little Bond episode in that Olympic opening ceremony, because I reckon, you know, one day Danny Boyle will make a Bond film, I hope.
That'd be nice.
Go to the Lighthouse website and you can make a booking through the site. And
yes, you can
reserve your seats. Do that, because
I think you get a free refreshment,
free drinks. I'm steady on the. I just got a bit carried away. Yeah, you can have a nice glass of bubbles or an orange juice.
All right, very generous of you. And it's not the biggest cinema in the world, so we're reasonably confident that it will sell out.
It's a very exclusive event, so you want to book.
Indeed. So come down from Auckland, those of you that are listening from up there. So all that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, I'm not going to do this because we've been going on for hours.
It's a good night for me.
It is. Kayleigh, do you want to just have a little quick rundown on social media and how people can find us?
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle @CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd, under Cinematica, which we have many new followers, so hello and thank you for following us on Letterboxd and also on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz.
Alright, the show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and we're going to leave you with some more music. There was really only one choice this week. We've discussed this already. Jacques Audiard's Rust and Bone features the best use of a Katy Perry song in cinema history. Here's Fireworks from the album Teenage Dream. Until next week, that's all from me.
All from me.
And
see you later.